Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Sustainable Connections podcast. I'm Mark Lee. I'm responsible for the ERM Sustainability Institute and an ERM partner. I'm your host if you've listened to Sustainable Connections before, and welcome back if indeed you have. I have a couple of fantastic guests with me today, and we're going to explore all issues relating to renewable energy, how we're developing it, how we're getting it to the people who want it, what it costs and why, also some of the social and community impacts that it's having and how we need to work to address those. If you are someone who follows the podcast, you know we tend to have an external guest and an ERM subject matter expert, and we have exactly that today. Really lucky to be joined by Kevin Hagen, who is the interim CEO of the Clean Energy Buyers Association, or CEBA. You'll probably hear us defaulting to that acronym at times during the conversation, but planting the full name with you now. And also Nikki Payne, who is an impact assessment and planning partner at ERM, but key to today's discussion, she is our renewables energy lead in North America. So welcome, Kevin. Welcome, Nikki. It's great to have you with us. And I'm going to just ask you to introduce yourselves in a little bit more depth than I just did. I think some people listening will probably know CEBA, but a whole bunch won't. And people won't have all had the good fortune that I've had over the years to get to know you. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about the role you're in now, but also a little bit about why you do it. So can you please explain CEBA for us and tell us a little bit about what you're doing there in your interim CEO role?
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity. The Clean Energy Buyers Association is a trade association made up of the biggest, most influential, I think, energy consumers in the US and increasingly globally. We're over 400 members who represent the real crux of the demand for clean energy in our corporate footprints, plus the energy partners, providers, and service providers that make up an ecosystem of the folks making this clean energy transition happen. Our core thinking is that business can make a big difference in the world. And the way we buy electricity, the way we buy energy matters. So by forcefully, or at least assertively asking for clean energy in our supply to run our businesses, we're able to really shift the way the market thinks about providing energy and electricity to C&I, commercial and industrial customers. Give you a little scale, we're over 400 members. The total market cap of our membership exceeds $15 trillion. Our collective energy consumption or electricity use is someplace in the neighborhood of 200 terawatt hours of electricity, which makes us one of the top 25 countries in the world in terms of comparing it to energy consumption. And since we started, we've driven over 77 gigawatts of clean energy transactions. So we're having a difference. It's making a difference in the shift to a clean energy future and to decarbonizing our businesses and decarbonizing the grid.
It sounds like a mechanism to move faster at scale. And I'm curious where that 25th largest country in the world, I think you said the other day that it's kind of, look out, Poland, here we come. We're about the same size as you, right? And it's a sense of the scale of the buying power in this group. We're going to get deeper into that for sure. Nikki, I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself and tell us about the work that you do inside ERM.
Sure. Yes. It's great to be with you here today, Kevin, and hear about CEBA. So ERM, I've been with this company 20 years, my whole career, and it has certainly been an exciting journey. ERM is a global consultancy. We've been in the renewable energy space for the last 25 years, starting with wind and hydroelectric facilities, and most recently moving into solar battery storage, part of the green hydrogen revolution, small modular nuclear, all of the exciting renewable technologies coming online today. In this space, ERM provides services across the full planning and permitting life cycle. So from advisory on interconnection strategy, siting, all the way through to stakeholder engagement and permitting and planning. So through our experience, where very much in the trenches with both developers, utilities, corporates, anybody who is excited about a renewable energy project coming online, we are very much aligned with them. Yeah, we're sort of on the other side of it, Kevin, from you, but certainly a lot of synergies. So excited about the conversation today.
One, I was thinking as you said that, Nikki, I was like, who isn't excited about renewables coming online? So we want to get them on the podcast and get them to account for themselves. But also what you finished with, as listened to both your intros, I was thinking, Kevin, it's almost like by through the association, you're bringing us the who and helping them organize to be more effective, impactful, and as you said, forceful in their ask for this. And Nikki, it sounds like your work is so much about the how. And we'll want to get more into both those things. Maybe kind of setting the stage among the three of us, but also for everybody listening. I think, you know, fair to say there is a climate crisis ongoing. The global need and ambition for renewables is incredibly high. And one thing we've actually talked about on this podcast before that I know both of you are aware of is the Global Renewables Alliance and the announcement and the kind of pledge that they led leading from the New York Climate Week last year into COP28 in Dubai to triple renewables and double efficiency by 2030. And it just gives you a sense of how fast we need to move. And ERM is a signatory to that. Kevin, I'm sure many of the members of SEBA are signatory to it as well. I know they are. So 2030 is tomorrow, right? It is now so close. We've been talking about these decadal transitions, but a whole bunch of them are now sneaking up on us. So are we going fast enough? What makes you hopeful that we can deliver? If we can get the renewables developed quickly enough, is the grid ready to receive everything that we want to pour into it?
No, on a linear projection, we're not on track to get to 2030. That's fact. I'm not convinced things move in linear lines in the business world. Never have before, probably aren't going to in the future. So I think that a linear projection forward is perhaps not the mechanism that we should think about in terms of whether we are quote unquote on track. At the same time, if it is veritable hockey stick coming, what evidence do we have that that is true? And should we really just wait? The answer is no, we shouldn't just wait. We have to make that acceleration happen. But there's a lot of evidence to say that we've got the right pieces in place. You know, when we look ahead towards what works today, my contention would be that if we have business models that make clean energy solutions more attractive, more reliable, more effective, more available than the alternative, then they win. And the truth is, that's kind of what's happening. Let's not assume this is just a walk of faith. The evidence, I think, is that corporate players at scale are able to do clean energy transactions with significant impact on their own clean energy future, as well as, you know, like we like to think, a customer-driven greener grid for everyone. So I think that's, you know, a piece of the puzzle. It is also true, I think, that as energy customers, although we have a wonderful opportunity to drive demand, supply has to keep up. And that's also part of the challenge today. We've demonstrated that corporate clients can buy a lot of clean energy when we have the opportunity. And the opportunity isn't equally distributed. There's lots of markets where we don't have access to choices. And even where we do have access to choices, it's getting fairly saturated. So it's a competitive market out there. So a lot of dynamics going on, but a lot of hope in that uncorking this this thing really can drive big change fast.
Kevin, the not linear thing landed on me so hard. I think we almost all need it tattooed. And people might know the work of Global Optimism. One of the things they're doing is we try and look at how we solve the climate challenge is to look at which technologies historically have scaled much faster than they've been projected to. And that's the adoption of everything from flush toilets to the internal combustion automobile to that there is a point where these things become reliable, desirable, everything, and they just take off. And I think we can see some of those curves with EVs, with some parts of the renewables supply chain. Nikki, when you think of 2030 and whether we can do this, you can confront Kevin on his interpretation of the facts if you want. Or pick up from the, we need to pick up the pace. And I'm curious what you think about how we pick up the pace, how we get this done.
Sure. Yeah. And there's so many dates out there with goals. So in the US, we have the Biden administration committed to carbon-free electricity by 2035 and then net zero emissions by 2050. So different goals, those are really dependent on how much electricity is consumed versus just building out, you know, three times the amount of renewable energy. And as you know, our demand for electricity is increasing exponentially as well. So I think that the, you know, what we're doing in renewables needs to continue to just grow exponentially, because even if it were linear, it's not going to meet the exponential increase in electricity demand. With that said, you know, every day that I'm working in this space, I see the right things falling into place to support that. And and I'll give some examples of that, but we're also seeing PV solar as an example is on that exponential growth curve currently. And between 2020 and 2025 is expected to grow by 75%. And we are seeing that every day, you know, more steel going in the ground. The many factors contribute to the ability for that trend to continue. And we are seeing domestic production of panels in the US. We've been working with a couple of independent power producers that are standing up their own manufacturing facilities in the US. And that trend is continuing and being fueled by the IRA. We're seeing queue reform but the idea to move these projects through faster because there's so much congestion in the interconnection queues. So that's a step in the right direction, as well as some FERC regulations to move that along. We're seeing things like improved battery storage technologies to not rely so heavily on the mining of critical minerals. And that's only going to get more advanced as we go, you know, over the next 5-10 years. And then lastly, on like the permitting side, we're seeing plans come out of the current administration that streamline large-scale development of renewables in the Western region where I sit on public lands. So there's a lot of factors that are needed to fall into place to fuel, you know, this exponential growth that we need to see. And I think every day there's progress on those fronts. So I'm hopeful that we're moving in the right direction. You know, if you look at the projections, we passed coal generation in 2020 and are on track to surpass natural gas generation within the next, I think, 5 years or so.
And those stats, both U.S., Nikki, or
Beverly? Those are U.S.
Yeah.
Those are U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm struck. So we do an annual leaders survey with a partner, GlobeScan, the institute here at ERM. And one of the things we asked people in the 2023 survey was which action or you know, event of the last 12 months has had the most impact on the pace of the sustainability agenda. And those expert respondents, about 80 countries, came back last year and they said, overwhelmingly, it is the pace of government regulation. In the three decades almost now that I've been working in this space, I don't think there are very many years in which expert respondents would have said that. You just rattled through many things happening as a result of the IRA, Nikki. And I just wonder if you build on that, is that policy push the thing that's creating the most momentum right now, or what else?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, the answer is yes. I can't even count on both hands how many of our clients are saying, okay, full steam ahead. It just comes down to the tax credits. And these projects are penciling out where previously they weren't. And so, yeah, it's full steam ahead. They have the, you know, these 40% boosters in some cases and are able to develop these projects economically. So absolutely. And because of the incentives around domestic panel manufacturing and some of these other aspects, it's really trickling into all of the pieces that are needed to come together. And Kevin, I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Mark, you said that there's a global, you know, your GlobeScan event, which is, by the way, I look forward to every year, is a global survey, you know, worldwide kind of perspective. Yep. And so I would color my commentary based on the fact that it is my perception that there's a fairly different regulatory government kind of mentality or approach between, for example, Europe and the U.S. I've heard
say it is so.
Yeah.
Kevin, really?
That.
Yeah.
Imagine that. I've heard people say, and I'm not saying it, but I've heard people say Europe's all about the sticks and we're all about the carrots. And I think there's something to be said for that. And certainly the current legislation kind of looks like that. So I think that when we say, so I absolutely believe that no one component of the social fabric can make this happen independently. We need government. We need the nonprofit NGO sector, advocacy, and we need the business community to work together on this. While the business community is developing and continues to accelerate demand for more and more clean energy, and of course, the other side of the business community is building out the assets and building the equipment to be able to deliver it, there's a whole lot of pieces in between that have to fall into place. I would say that as much as it's the regulatory environment, I would say it's as much the get out of the way part of the regulatory environment as it is about creating the constructs for incentives. So while the IRA is great and obviously has accelerated interest, demand, investment, there's a whole bunch of things that still need to get done in order to make this happen. Nikki mentioned FERC regulations. As the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is responsible for things like gas pipelines and transmission lines across the country and coming up with especially an interstate regulatory environment, helping to smooth those things and make those things happen. Well, you know, one example would be, it would be great, in our opinion, if transmission lines got treated the same way as gas lines in terms of regulatory oversight, but they're not. And so a gas line gets approved once and gets built across the state lines, across the way. Take it or leave it. I mean, you can fight over it, but it's one process. It's a known process that helps make that happen. A similar transmission line would have to get permitted in every jurisdiction that it goes through, all the way across the state, across states, across the region, which is untenable. It takes 15 years to permit a transmission line, let alone to actually build it. That's beyond 2030. Let's just put it that way. So we need to do some work there. And then finally, the third leg of the stool is the civil community, right? The community connection. We're going to have to work together to decide what clean energy solutions we want. We've been really good at knowing what we're against. The opportunity to work together on what we want to get built. Now, let's admit, nobody wants to run a power line through Yellowstone or through Yosemite or through a sacred place. But there are lots of places where transmission lines really do need to get built in order for all of us to have a reliable, affordable, resilient, environmentally and socially responsible energy future. And it's really going to be about building the right assets in the right places at the right times, fast enough to be able to meet our country's need for energy infrastructure. So all three legs of the stool are going to have to work together to make this happen.
Yeah, no, lots there that makes so much sense. And I think just a real ring of truth to the, it's easier to say what we don't want than it is to articulate and accept the things that even if we 100% don't want them, we've agreed we somehow need. So how do we get there? Kevin, you mentioned earlier in the conversation a little bit about supply and demand, and I think you were framing it as, you know, our members are really good at buying renewable electricity when they can get their hands on it. And the implication or the hint there seemed to be, and it goes with everything you and Nikki just said about the challenge of developing the renewable energy supply, that it's not all there, that folks, I think, I'll pass it back to you, would be buying more if they could access it. So I'd love to hear a bit about what you think about the balance, demand and supply right now, and how we get them better in balance, if that's what needs to be done. And then we're going to move on from there into price and cost, but maybe let's pick that up as the second half of this.
We, I think, have an appetite for as much clean energy as we could make right now. A while ago, the thought was, hey, we need to replace coal with new clean energy, or we need to, you know, decommission a polluting plant and replace it with clean energy solutions. And while that's still a component of the conversation, today with the incredible acceleration of energy needs, just point, you know, all energy need, as we switch from fossil fuels to other solutions, we're going to replace, for example, a lot of the fuel that we burn at the pump to electricity. There's, you know, we all use a whole lot more digital infrastructure in our phones and our cat videos, as well as our businesses and all the things that we run on. That takes a lot more data and data centers. And the cloud is not theoretical. It is a place and it consumes a lot of power. People think about the potential for artificial intelligence and all the more sophisticated digital world taking even more power. And then, you know, here in the US, we would love to repatriate a whole bunch of manufacturing. For example, the battery technologies and the new technologies that Nikki was just talking about, it'd be great to build those factories here. Well, that takes energy. So that every successful economy since the Romans has been built on abundant, low-cost energy. And certainly the United States economy has over, you know, several generations. Natural gas was the cheap, abundant energy. Today, the cheapest, most abundant, most reliable power we've got happens to be carbon free. And in most cases, it's renewable. So given that case, given that structure, why not build an economy on that? And I think that's what we need to go forward with. The challenge is that we got to reorient a whole lot of things, maybe as much as double the grid, at least 50% more grid than we have today in order to do that. And that's going to take an industrial and a revolution in electricity that we've never seen. And we've never seen that kind of growth in electricity. For the last 20 or 25 years, there's been basically no growth in the total amount of electricity we use because efficiency has compensated for the increase.
Yeah, Kevin, in what you said there, just the scale of what we need to do. Efficiency, of course, doesn't become unimportant, but we also need to at least double supply. And as we look at what AI demand might be, there's rumors that we're going to need to triple supply. It's an incredible step. But Nikki, I just want to let you roll forward on this kind of supply demand conundrum.
I was in the middle of a conversation between a mid-cap data center developer and the largest IPP in the U.S., independent power producer in the U.S., where the data center client asked what they were trying to align their data center with a VPPA solution and said, what is the soonest you could provide power, you know, to these locations? And it was end of 2026. The 2025 options are already under contract. The next round is 2026. And the reason for that was all grid-based, supply chain-based, waiting on equipment and results. So that was just a really eye-opening conversation to be in the middle of. They could not turn the lights on this data center for, you know, a few years because of the constraints and the congestion in the queue and the constraints with the grid. Yeah. And I'm seeing a lot of our clients are citing projects where future transmission is going to be built. And in some cases, that's 2030. They have CODs 2031. And they're having to plan now, which is really scary. Like the level of sophistication you need to have to get in front. It's interesting because it's nuanced and there's constraints, but in that way, it creates more competition. So, I mean, the people that I'm dealing with in the renewable energy industry are incredibly sophisticated. And it's like the more experienced people are going to win out because you need to be basically five steps ahead mm-hmm. and understand where these future grids are even going to be built and then get in line. So by the time that, you know, a transmission line is announced, everybody's already has applications in with the queue. So then it's too late. So it's really been a fascinating business to be a part of. And yeah, I will definitely say that the demand exceeds supply at the moment.
We're counting on that transmission line being there when we've put our kit in place and, you know, very smart people figuring it out and making the most strategic bets they can, but a risk. But Kevin, you were going to jump in.
Mark, you just got to jump in there to say that that's our economy at risk. That's sure. That's one person's or one organization's business model that needs to get smart, fast, whatever, who's going to win, who's not. But we can't risk our entire future economic growth on the few folks that are going to be smart enough to figure out where to put their next plant 5 and 8 years ahead of time. Our economy and our growth, our jobs, needs more opportunity for a lot more growth. And, you know, we got to just regular smart business people have to be able to win, right? I mean, not just the geniuses, right? Which, and by the way, there's certainly some of those too. I was in a conversation recently where someone was talking about going to buy a transformer for an installation and found that some smart business folks had already bought the next 3 years of manufacturing capacity.
Wow.
Of that plant. There are folks thinking ahead and they see their contingencies, and that's great. But, you know, some of, you know, I think SIBA is a great example. We've got members who have so much thoughtfulness around their energy future that they have dozens, in fact, hundreds of people working on energy strategy and energy procurement in their business. And then there's everybody else who's got one person, maybe, who is supposed to have been figuring this out all along. Our utility industry and our energy infrastructure has been so successful that we've been lulled into this false sense of security that it's always going to be there. The lights are always going to come on. It's always going to be cost effective, or we're going to complain about the bill. And there's always going to be power, so just build it and they run a line to you. That is not where we are today. And it is very hard for most businesses to make the shift from this ubiquitous, commoditized, don't even think about it concept to electricity is a critical input to your business, as critical as your employees, as critical as your critical suppliers, as critical as anything, any other input to your business, and you've never thought about it before.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden, every average business, the next Fortune 100, you know, the 200 through 500 of the Fortune 500 are all thinking, oh my goodness, I'm way behind the curve. I need capacity. I need people. I need expertise. I need help. I need ERM, I need SIBA to be able to recognize the opportunity here and you know, mitigate the risks associated with a whole new electricity future.
Yeah, I'm glad in the middle of that to hear that those smart people are thinking ahead and being that strategic. But the crisis in that is that they have to, because there isn't enough for everybody. So it's, you know, smart people planning how their organization can win. And I liked how you built it up to the, no, this is about the competitiveness of our economy as a whole. And we don't want a minimum number of winners and the rest of it being dragged down. Kevin, sticking with you for just a sec, I said I wanted to come to this cost price piece, and it's obviously deeply connected to the supply and demand, but it's causing some surprises and some pain in the system in terms of where the price end of this is versus where folks had maybe thought it was going to be, that green energy is going to be clean and abundant and cheap. And that's not always the case right now. Can you expand a bit on that?
Yeah, I spent 8 years as chief sustainability officer for REI, outdoor retailer. And one of the most important things I learned in a career in retail was price and cost are independent variables. The what you paid for it and what you charge for it are loosely related. And that's why markets work. So while on the one hand, we've been building demand for clean energy like crazy, and that's great news. On the other hand, that means that supply of clean energy at the PPA level, at the supply ready to do deals level, is harder. It's a harder environment. And the evidence of that is the price is going up. You've got to really be thoughtful about how you do those deals in order to make things work at the PPA, the power purchase agreement level. A few years ago, you know, I was able to say when I was head of sustainability at Iron Mountain, a mid-scale data center company. By the time I left there, we were buying a terawatt hour of clean energy per year. And we had about 80% of our global footprint, and we had never paid more than grid for green power. It is pretty tough for folks to be able to make that claim today. You got to be a lot more creative about how you think about the cost of energy. Now, the good news is, given the uncertainty of where we're headed, a firm fixed price deal today at any price is probably a good deal, because the alternative is very uncertain and there is a cost of uncertainty. However, that's not my favorite compelling economic argument for doing clean energy deals. So access to more, getting more on the grid and getting more available to even more buyers is pretty critical to keeping pace with where you want to go.
Yeah. And Nikki, are you seeing that affect the folks you work with? Are people pausing and wondering if pricing will improve, or are they rushing to secure everything they can, or some combination of both, perhaps? How's it playing out?
Yeah, it seems that, I mean, if you have a PPA, that's a win. So some are in situations where they don't have any off-taker yet, and that's obviously a project killer. So having some surety in what price you're going to get at least helps to plan and figure out, you know, how the project's going to pencil. It does seem like folks are trying to move into these bilateral deals more and more. And there seems to be some price stabilization with that, where the off-taker is happy to have, know that that power is coming to them and that they're going to have it and that it's green. And I think that there's some more flexibility in the, it's a more favorable pricing structure, I think, for both parties. Honestly, every project seems to have a different situation, and you need to, like I said, just have these really sophisticated negotiators at the table that understand how to play that game.
There we go. Well, we could spend, I think, more time kind of trying to unpick those parts, but I want to move on. There's a couple more topic areas I'd like to bounce off both of you. One is that we're talking about renewables, and that's a big bundle. It's actually a whole bunch of different things that are all cleaner energy. So wind, solar, geothermal, you know, long list. And they're not all moving at the same pace. And some of the parts of the industry are struggling to get online more than others. And Nikki, I just wonder if you can break that down. What are you seeing? Like you mentioned acceleration in PV solar. Which other things are moving really fast? Which parts of what we're trying to develop are maybe not enjoying that same momentum right now?
Wind and solar are at the top, kind of neck and neck at the moment. Wind is increasing at a slower pace, I think, just because a lot of the wind developers have shifted over towards solar. There are still some that are hanging in there. And for a while, wind had the lowest levelized cost of energy. So it was actually the cheapest sort of energy to generate from, you know, the CapEx side. But now solar is lower, or soon to be lower, with the improvements in the panel technology. So it's easier to develop solar is what it comes down to. So I think where businesses see the business model to shift towards solar, they are. And solar is, you know, on pace to surpass wind next year for the amount of overall gigawatts that are being produced. Is, I'm talking about the U.S. Sorry, I have a very U.S. focused. Yep. Kevin, I mean, that's the stats I'm looking at. Do you have the same viewpoint on that?
I also think that because of the challenges around getting large scale deals done, I think there's a bit of early indicators that deals are getting smaller, especially for, you know, folks looking behind the meter or on site. That takes a lot more transactions and more complex transactions to get the same terawatt hour of an electricity supply, but you can do it. And the economics, once sort of the mold is broken there and people get used to how to do those deals, there's more opportunity for them sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. People trying to be more nimble, get projects through faster at the distribution level, or just direct C&I behind the meter solution. So yeah, I think that if we were to look at the breakdown of the solar gigawatts being produced, I would definitely expect to see more that percentage for behind the meter solutions increasing quickly.
And Nikki, you were talking earlier about wind versus solar. I'm also curious if you can break down what is happening with wind and wind. It seems like the story around onshore and offshore has diverged. And can you kind of describe the current state and where you think things might be headed?
Sure. Well, with offshore wind, I think what we saw this past year is that there was some hesitancy on the part of these wind developers. We see that the oil and gas majors are still in the mix because their shareholders want to see offshore wind as part of their portfolio. So we're seeing, for example, in the Gulf, there was a lease auction and only RWE bid. So, you know, we're seeing those trends in the U.S. as the Ørsteds and the offshore wind developers are having a hard time penciling it. And the reason for that is because the supply chain is not quite where it needs to be. The manufacturing facilities to manufacture the turbines have not yet been built. So it's a few years behind where it's a sound investment. There are certainly a lot of companies that are, you know, investing. ERM produced the EIS for the first offshore wind farm in the US, Vineyard Wind, which just started operations this year. In my understanding is that it does just depend on the market and the PPA. And, you know, Vineyard Wind is operating and is working out. At least, you know, that was worth the investment. There's others that are backing out because of the prices, like we were talking about. So this year was definitely slower than we expected in terms of development and progress because of that hesitancy. But hoping with what's coming out of the IRA and improvements to supply chain and these other projects coming online, that we're going to see, you know, the floodgates open, if you will, over the next few years.
Yep. And just checking quickly on acronyms again, the work ERM did on the Vineyard piece was the environmental impact assessment, right?
On behalf of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management.
So in Europe, offshore wind is where it's at, right? The scale, size, cost is driving everything to a place where those wind farms offshore are in a significant percentage of the new developed resources coming online. And that's kind of the future, I think. You know, one of the great things about wind offshore is it's 20 miles from where the people are. You don't need a transmission line from the Midwest all the way to the coast, right? So that's all good news. So I think that a lot of this is immaturity of the space. So it's uncertainty as much as it is cost. I mean, the uncertainty problem. And then when you talk about supply chain, it's all kinds of things. When Ørsted started looking at major offshore wind development, they had to build a boat. Build a huge, expensive ship that can actually do the installation offshore. So when you're looking at supply chain, there's a lot of pieces of this puzzle, all of them uncertain. And I think the last piece here of uncertainty is the regulatory/permitting process being subject to an awful lot of public input. And that public input, despite the resounding support for renewables across the public, there are activist folks, and I'm going to say from vested interests, because that's my assertion, not any, you know, who are actively working to help undermine that entire picture. You know, we have stories of dead whales washing up and people attributing that to wind farms, and there aren't even any wind farms there yet. So I think the organized, I'll assert, organized opposition through other means, I think is a piece of the challenge today in terms of being able to develop a manageable risk scenario for developers to go get this done.
And Kevin, that pivot takes us in a direction, at least I wanted to go, which was kind of, you know, the people side of this broadly. And you've talked about the negative impacts of vested interests who are opposing, maybe at times without really faithful information. But we also have the communities that are along the transmission line pathways. We have the communities at the coast where the offshore wind might be built. We have the people in the supply chains, and there's a big social element of building the renewables economy, making the transition to the low carbon economy that is full of challenges, from human rights related in solar panel production through to those community impacts at sites. And Do you, both of you, see us making pace on that set of issues? Are we making progress? Is this industry getting better at mitigating social harms?
Using offshore wind as an example, in California, because we've been involved with that over the many years that's been discussed, the California Coastal Commission and other agencies have been very proactive in involving all the tribal groups, all of the environmental groups, and bringing them to the table in establishing these lease areas up front. There's definitely a recognition that there's real issues that need to be addressed and then opposition that's going to occur no matter what. And so bringing all the stakeholders to the table early to try to get in front of those sorts of issues. And there's been a lot of work that's gone into finding the best lease areas that we're going to minimize, you know, environmental and tribal impacts. And now there are consortiums and groups formed to discuss this at the table all together as these developers are moving through the process. So I think just using that as an example, there's a lot of work that's been done collaboratively already, you know, before the projects even start the permitting process. Onshore renewables, it is so complex dealing with trying to navigate what projects are going to be opposed or not. And you know, ERM undertakes social risk and opportunity assessments where we're looking for opportunities to work with communities and find ways for community benefit agreements and to reduce impacts, of course. It's complex. Kevin, I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Kevin, solve this. It's complex.
Yeah. So, well, I can take a stab here. SEBA has been vocal and very public about our position and the position of our membership as a whole around this sort of general topic. I'm going to contradict Nikki just slightly and say we're not trying to mitigate impact. We're trying to maximize the impact of clean energy transition in a good way. Let's make it positive. Mm-hmm. And that might sound like Pollyanna at first, forgive me, but that's just because in the conventional way of thinking, it would be. We need to think differently about the way we do stuff. In fact, if we develop renewable, I'll be assertive. This is me being editorial here for a second. But if we develop renewable and clean energy resources with the same thought process that we developed fossil fuel, we're going to get the same outcomes, maybe with a little less fossil fuel. So the answer, I think, for us is to really think differently about the whole, you know, market. I'm taking a page out of your book here from the way I've read it from forever, which is and literally and figuratively, which is we got to think differently if we're going to get different outcomes in a sustainable business future. So SEBA has taken some steps around this and helped ourselves. You know, we can't just assume that folks thinking about renewable energy solutions and clean energy solutions, you're going to think differently about the rest of their business model and about the rest of the impacts in their organization. So we've been a little proactive here. SEBA has developed something called the Principles of Purpose-Driven Power Procurement.
You think promised I might have won you'd the get bet. That in. And you there it is.
I think
there
I might have won the bet. I got to say it right.
Yeah.
This is a set of principles that SEBA members are signing on to that really say, hey, we expect that renewable energy assets and renewable energy deals are going to be done in a different way. We're going to think through the environmental and social responsibility of our business practices, stem to stern, as we think about deploying new clean energy assets. And I think that's the power of the buyer, right? We can say that. And now we can compete, make the market compete for how to deliver on that and put all the creativity and resources and innovation of the businesses in the supply chain into how to solve that great, as opposed to how to bury it deep. So I think that's a secret sauce to how we're getting there. And it's a piece that I'm proud of where SEBA is and proud of SEBA members for raising their hand on this and expecting more and unleashing the creativity and innovation of the marketplace to give us more of the right stuff.
Yeah, I think it's a nice summary statement in a way. I know it's far more than a summary statement for SEBA, but if it went by people too quickly, you know, that's the principles of purpose-driven power procurement. I'm very proud I got that out in one shot. And if you think about it, right, we could just have power procurement and we, you know, make it happen. it could be purpose-driven. That would be better. And it would be even better if we could think through the principles that kind of define that purpose. And so I love that Seba has bundled all that together and is doing that collectively with all the companies who are part of that. We're glad to be a member for that reason and many others, Kevin. I have to say, I'm so glad to have had this conversation with both of you. The time we booked has flown by. It's been fun. It's been informative, and I'm really appreciative of both your time. So thank you both so much. To everybody who's been listening to us, if you're interested in other Sustainable Connections podcasts, you can find them all on your favorite platform. You know which those are. You can also find the whole collection on erm.com, as well as more about us and the rest of our work. But most importantly, again, thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Nikki. It's been such a delight to have this conversation.